Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Cade Crockford, Director of the Technology for Liberty Project at the ACLU of Massachusetts, who assesses the shortcomings in President Obama's proposed reforms of the National Security Agency's massive surveillance program. Peter Hart of the Media Watch Group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who examines the possible industry-wide fallout from the recent purchase of the Washington Post newspaper by billionaire Amazon.com CEO Jeff Bezos. And Vincent Mann, sub-chief of the Ramapo Lenape Nation, who talks about the recent journey down New York's Hudson River of Native and non-Native paddlers to commemorate the 400th anniversary of the first treaty signed between America's indigenous peoples and European settlers. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Three weeks after winning an appeal on a dubious felony conviction, Russian blogger and dissident Alexei Navalny has launched a full-scale campaign for mayor of Moscow with street rallies, campaign leaflets, and populist speeches. Odds are against a victory for Navalny, a 37-year-old lawyer who 2 years ago blasted President Vladimir Putin and his United Russia Party as the party of crooks and thieves. Navalny is facing off against acting mayor Sergei Sobyanin, a technocrat appointed by the Kremlin. Early polling gives Sobyanin over 50% of the vote in the September 8th election, the first mayoral election in the city in a decade. For now, Navalny's backers hope to win 20% of the vote as a test of strength for the resurgent anti-Putin movement. There are three other challengers in the race, but the mayoral contest is coming down to Navalny and Sobyanin, the Kremlin insider. As the Moscow Times observed, it's a conflict between the first post-Soviet and the last Soviet generation, as people in their 20s and 30s see their future being stolen by people in their 60s. Since the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, last December, there has been an increased call for mandatory treatment of the mentally ill. The horrifying murder of 20 first graders and 6 educators in Newtown has renewed a debate over how far police and healthcare workers should go to compel the mentally ill to seek treatment. For now, many health professionals reject forced treatment. Dominic Hult of the Bazelon Center for Mental Health Laws told the Christian Science Monitor, "There may be people who are mentally ill and become violent, but you can't identify them. But that's true of all people. And mental illness tells you almost nothing about the likelihood they'll be violent." Countering that view is Eve Fuller Torrey, founder of the Treatment Advocacy Center, who has developed a database of what he describes as thousands of preventable tragedies involving the mentally ill. Torrey insists, "You've got to clean up the commitment laws so you can evaluate people before they commit a horrendous act." However, a new alternative model is emerging, referred to as peer-to-peer counseling. In New York, Parachute NYC runs guest homes with support services where the mentally ill can reside voluntarily. The practitioners of peer-to-peer counseling believe that a more welcoming, person-centered approach at the onset of illness can prevent more serious episodes and involuntary hospitalization later on. According to the publication Labor Notes, over 20 Walmart workers were fired for missing work while they went out on strike in June, even though the workers had notified their managers that they would be absent. Norma Dobbins was also fired after she traveled to New York City to protest outside the Upper East Side Manhattan apartment of Walmart director Christopher Williams. Many of the fired workers are members of Our Walmart, the union-backed organization United for Respect at Walmart, whose members traveled to the big retailer's annual meeting in Bentonville, Arkansas, to air their grievances. Over the last 3 years, Our Walmart has organized numerous high-profile protests, including during the 2012 post-Thanksgiving holiday Black Friday shopping spree. Since the retaliatory firings, Our Walmart has also turned up the heat on Walmart board members. 5 activists were arrested outside of Yahoo's annual shareholder meeting in Sunnyvale, California, on June 24th, where they targeted Yahoo's CEO Marissa Mayer, a member of the Walmart board. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon, For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
It wasn't long after a surprisingly close vote on legislation in the U.S. House of Representatives that would have defunded the National Security Agency surveillance program that collects massive amounts of data on U.S. citizens' phone communications that President Obama came forward in an August 9th press conference to propose his own set of reforms to his administration's spy programs. While the president rejected the assertion by many that Edward Snowden, the former NSA contractor who leaked details of his former employer's surveillance programs, was a hero, it was clear that his revelations were driving the debate on reform in Washington and around the country. Specifically, the president proposed revising Section 215 of the Patriot Act that gives the government broad authority to collect phone communications records. Mr. Obama also said he would work with Congress to reconstitute the secretive Foreign Intelligence Surveillance or FISA Court, which grants the NSA legal authority for its bulk collection of phone and internet data to make it more adversarial and establish a civil liberties advocate to have a non-specified role during court proceedings. Lastly, the president said he'll require more transparency of the surveillance programs and create a panel of former intelligence officials and privacy advocates to assess the NSA programs and suggest further reforms. Your reporter spoke with Cade Crockford, director of the Technology for Liberty Project at the ACLU of Massachusetts, who assesses the shortcomings in President Obama's NSA reform proposals and suggests the most effective path to safeguard national security without sacrificing liberty and the right to privacy.
It's a good thing that the president is talking about reforming the surveillance state. It's really unfortunate, however, that his comments were pretty duplicitous, actually. The president only spoke to the 215 program, which is it's Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act, and this is the statute that authorizes the bulk records collection. So, for example, the Verizon business order that was disclosed by Edward Snowden and published by the Guardian newspaper, this kind of order that enables the government to collect in bulk all of our phone records, this is authorized under the 215 program. And unfortunately, what President Obama did not say about the 215 program is that it's going to end. The president and the national security establishment appear to believe that this is a necessary instrument in the service of protecting the country. This, although they have not provided any evidence that this is actually the case, the couple of cases that the officials like to trot out, in fact, are not evidence that 215 was instrumental in stopping any terrorist plots. And the other proposals that he made are pretty decent. Clearly, we need more transparency, and his comments were pretty vague, so we don't exactly know what he means by more transparency. You know, the idea to have something of an investigation, an inquiry into NSA surveillance is a really good one. The tricky part is who's going to be doing that oversight. That is actually really critical. Is James Clapper, the head of the director of national intelligence, is he going to be doing that oversight? I would suggest that that's not proper oversight. Someone externally should be investigating. Certainly, you know, the Church Committee in the 1970s, which investigated the COINTELPRO abuses and the NSA abuses, when the NSA was turning its surveillance equipment at the time on American anti-war activists, for example, the Church Committee exposed a lot of those abuses and led to substantial reform to the surveillance state. I do not think that such an inquiry, if it is led by somebody like James Clapper or former NSA director Michael Hayden, would do such a thing. So we really need more details about what the president means with respect to any kind of inquiry. And finally, the FISA court proposal is a good one, but it's only really a good one if we have changes to the laws that enable the government to conduct broad warrantless surveillance of Americans. We really have to get rid of Section 215 of the Patriot Act. It should be repealed, as well as something the president completely avoided in his remarks, which is Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act. And this is the pernicious statute that authorizes warrantless surveillance of the content of Americans' communications, of our international communications, and is the statute that authorizes things like the prison program. So the president didn't even mention that at all, and this is troubling in the extreme.
President Obama says he's long an advocate of reforming these surveillance systems, indicating that Edward Snowden's revelations to the Guardian newspaper, the Washington Post, and others really had nothing to do with it. But why don't you give us your take? What role do you think he played in provoking the White House, the president, to come out with these reform proposals?
Well, Edward Snowden clearly played a very central role. I think everybody in the country is incredibly attuned to the kinds of surveillance that the NSA has been conducting only as a result of Edward Snowden's leaks, as a result of him blowing the whistle to the American public about what our government has been doing in the shadows, and frankly, what our government has been lying to us about what it's doing in the shadows for a number of years.
Cade, what is your prescription for effectively reforming or transforming the nation's surveillance programs to both respect privacy and free speech while giving the government tools it says it needs to prevent terrorist attacks and other threats?
Well, the Fourth Amendment really is the gold standard of American justice, and there's no reason why any surveillance programs can't comport with the Fourth Amendment. No judge is ever going to refuse a legitimate request for surveilling people who the government, you know, reasonably believes are involved in some kind of terrorist activity. It's just like a criminal case, right? So the real issue is that we really need to repeal Sections 215 of the Patriot Act, again, which is the program that authorizes this bulk records collection. And I just want to say very quickly that Ron Wyden has hinted that it's not just phone records, that it may be as well credit card records in bulk, banking records in bulk, medical records, even location records in bulk. So we need to repeal Section 215 of the Patriot Act, as well as repeal Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act, which is what authorizes PRISM and the content collection, the warrantless content collection.
That was Cade Crockford, Director of the Technology for Liberty Project at the Massachusetts chapter of the ACLU. Find links to groups actively working to defend civil liberties by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The August 5th announcement that Amazon.com CEO and founder Jeff Bezos would purchase the Washington Post newspaper for $250 million was a shock to many reporters and editors at the newspaper and to many working in the media industry across the country. The family-owned newspaper, known best for breaking stories about the Nixon-era Watergate scandal by investigative reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, has seen a 37% drop in readership over the past 10 years, severe reductions in its newsroom staff, and the closure of several news bureaus. The purchase of the Washington Post came on the heels of the sale of another iconic newspaper, the Boston Globe, owned by the New York Times, to multimillionaire Red Sox baseball team owner John W. Henry for $70 million. As in all purchases of influential media outlets, there are serious questions about where billionaire Jeff Bezos will take the 136-year-old Washington Post. Will Bezos' Amazon.com business agenda create conflicts of interest for the newspaper? Some observers hope that Bezos' deep pockets will revive the newspaper and once again allocate funding to in-depth and investigative reporting. Others predict that the man who revolutionized the digital marketplace at Amazon will strive to dramatically transform the nation's newspaper industry. Your reporter spoke with Peter Hart, activism director with the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Here he examines the possible fallout from Bezos' acquisition of the Washington Post and changes ahead for U.S. media companies.
I guess the optimist take is that, and I don't really consider myself part of this group, but there is a case to be made for optimism in that you have people with deep pockets who seem to be interested in these properties for the sake of reinvigorating journalism or coming up with a new model for commercial journalism since the old model, which relied on classified advertisements and, you know, those full-color insert ads, is just not there anymore. The flip side, of course, is I think the question that the rest of us have to ask ourselves is, why would somebody who's very successful in business, very wealthy beyond our wildest dreams, why would those people buy newspapers? Newspapers are a business that everyone agrees is falling apart. There's no way to make a profit. These are not people who are into charitable enterprise. So what is it about these papers that makes them attractive? And I think there's at least two answers. The first one is they're buying them cheap, and any businessman wants to get in at the bottom instead of the top. And the other thing is that what does a local newspaper give you other than an ability to set a tone in a particular city, to set an agenda, to be in some ways the loudest voice in the media cacophony in any particular large city? And in the case of the Washington Post, you know, it has influence over the rest of the country and the way the rest of the media look at the world. So if you're looking at it from that perspective, I guess you could say that they're spending very little money to have an enormous influence over the public debate. And if you're somebody with excess cash and maybe some interests that you want to promote, owning the local newspaper isn't a bad way to do it. Might not be good for the rest of us. But from their perspective, I think that's the first question we have to ask ourselves, is why these people are interested in these things. And there's a couple of other case studies of ownership that's similar to this that might give us some hints and get us away from the purely optimistic take that, well, you know, at least it's not the Koch brothers.
Well, what do we know about Amazon.com's founder and billionaire CEO, Jeff Bezos, and his agenda? We do know that he's anti-union. We know that he favors the privatization of education. What else do we know about Jeff Bezos and what he might bring as publisher, the new publisher of the Washington Post?
Yeah, you know, the education policy was something I didn't know until it kind of was, I think, in the bottom of one of the stories about his political profile. He doesn't have a strong one. He's made some donations to Democratic candidates and Democratic politicians. He put a lot of money into a marriage equality initiative in the state of Washington. He also put a lot of money into defeating an increase in the state income tax on the wealthy. And I think that, you know, if you have to summarize his interests, political interests, I think it might be that. He's a very rich guy who wants to not pay more in taxes, either for himself or for his company. Amazon resisted any kind of internet-based sales taxes. Now they have a slightly modified plan that they're supporting, which would, you know, since they have physical locations in so many states, they're going to pay taxes anyway. So now they're trying to make sure that the taxes they used to oppose on internet companies will be paid by their competitors who might not have as much physical infrastructure as they do. So, you know, the question becomes, are there interests, either political interests or personal vested interests that he has that will come before politicians in Washington? The answer is absolutely. Of course they will. This is a guy who runs the company that got awarded the multi-million dollar contract to host the CIA's cloud computer network. Conceivably, other government agencies are going to be looking for computer solutions and security in the near future. So Amazon's going to be positioned as the leader in this industry and as the company owned by the guy who owns the local paper. On any level, that's a conflict of interest. And remember, in journalism, a conflict of interest is not, do you skew the news in order to serve your bottom line or serve your political interests or what have you. It is, does that conflict exist? And if it does, then that's a problem, and that's something that the media outlet has to come to grips with and figure out how it needs to disclose this. The other aspect that I think could come into play is, and you've seen a couple of hints about this, is taking the Amazon model and adapting it to journalism. So WashingtonPost.com becomes a place where ads are targeted to you based on what you've purchased from Amazon, what you've listened to, and so forth. The news can be tailored the same way. They know what nonfiction titles you buy from Amazon.com. And one can imagine that Jeff Bezos can only see a profitability down the road for the Washington Post if they can treat it the same way they treat their other properties, which is to say, how can we extract the most out of these reader/customers and sell it to our advertisers and sell it to booksellers and share it with Amazon.com and create this new revenue stream out of what used to be a newspaper website? It remains to be seen how it's going to shake out, but it would be shocking if somebody who's in this business decided not to employ these kinds of strategies, which I think will raise real questions about what they're doing on the journalistic side.
That was Peter Hart, activism director with the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. For more analysis on the purchase of the Washington Post and other media trends, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. August 9th marked the end of a two-week journey by canoe and kayak to New York City from central New York State by teams of native and non-native paddlers to commemorate the 400th anniversary of the first treaty signed between America's indigenous peoples and European settlers called the Two-Row Wampum Treaty. Parties to the Treaty of 1613 included leaders of the Iroquois Confederacy, or Haudenosaunee, and the Dutch. The Two-Row Wampum Renewal Campaign set out from Onondaga Nation near Syracuse on July 28th with 15 native paddlers. They were later joined in Albany by up to 200 more paddlers for part or all of the 140-mile voyage down the Hudson River to Pier 96 in New York City, where paddlers were welcomed by hundreds of well-wishers, including the Dutch Consul General. The original wampum belt has two parallel rows of blue beads on a white bead background, signifying equality, friendship, and mutual respect between the parties as they traveled the River of Life. It is the basis for the 500 treaties that followed, all of which have been broken by European settlers and their descendants in the United States. Members of a non-native group called Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation also helped coordinate the event. Participants in the river journey expressed their opposition to hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, for natural gas, and call for protection of the land, air, and water for future generations. Native American activists also call for respect for their sovereignty as independent nations. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was on the pier awaiting the arrival of the paddlers and spoke to Vincent Mann, sub-chief of the Ramapo Lenape Nation, whose historic territory was very close to New York City. Here he talks about his hopes for an improvement in relations between Native Americans and the U.S. government, and the importance of the river renewal campaign in that process.
It's amazing, to actually finally see unity and allies coming together for a common cause. And I think it's a tremendous thing, because it's not just Native people, you know. It's just people who have good conscience and a good heart all coming together, so it's good.
If you could say in your own words what you think the goal of this whole journey is.
You know, the goal of this journey is for the United States government to honor our treaties. Not just the Two Row, but for all the treaties, to honor us as Native people and to not treat us like third world country. And they often do that way too much. And I think that what's starting to happen now, for lack of a better word, it's like a renaissance of Native people who are starting to stand up. You know, it's been too long where we have to hide. You know, our core group of our tribe is only 39 miles from this city. Split Rock, which was the last place that was recorded for a corn ceremony, you stand there, you see Manhattan, you know, you see the skyline. And so for us to actually be here and welcoming the Onondaga is a tremendous thing. And so hopefully this will keep moving forward. We do have a sacred hoop that has evolved out of this so that we can keep moving these things forward. Including the environment, you know, fracking and new pipelines and desalination plants and all those things. So I think that as we come together and with more numbers of people that have the same causes in their heart, that it'll turn into be a really good thing.
Is this journey in any way about forgiveness?
I mean, that's a good question. Forgiveness from who?
I guess the people who broke the treaties or the descendants of the people who broke the treaties.
I don't think that we should be asking them to ask us for forgiveness. And if they don't have it in their heart to honor those treaties, you know, I mean, that's on them. Somebody had put up a thing on Facebook, another native. He said, just as a hypothetical thing, that if the power went out in New York City, would we help them? And I watched it for about a week, and it started to fester. And at the end of that week, I had decided that I'd seen enough, and I took in enough, and then I spoke my words on there. And my words was that we wouldn't have a choice but to help them. Because if we failed to help them, then we were going to fail ourselves. Because the disease that would be born out of that would come and likely kill us also. So this is about unity. things can be forgiven if people are going to do the right thing. And if we all come together, then forgiveness is just something that will happen. You know, people that have good hearts, you know, it's our job to show other people how to live with humility and how to walk with humility, because it's the difference between being humiliated all your lives and hiding in plain sight and walking with humility. And, you know, to be humble, you know, to think that none of us are better than the next person or next being or next animal or tree, plant, grass. And so if we all have that and we start to embrace that, you know, which is the old ways, and if we embrace that, then forgiveness will just be a part of what we're doing.
Is there anything specific, and I know you're going to the UN, and is there anything that this project with all these people will go to the UN specifically to ask for? Do you know?
It's to honor our treaties, you know, and it's to protect our water. And, you know, this water here, not too far from here, it's actually a Superfund site. And how do you clean that with a tide that, you know, ebbs and flows? And, you know, our tribe itself has been dealing with toxic paint sludge for 49 years that's been dumped in mine shafts by Ford. You know, we need help with that. So part of that is uniting with other tribes, and it is uniting with people from other descents, and to stand up to fight for what's right, you know. The state of New Jersey, a couple of weeks back, they had a community of 300-plus homes, probably $500,000 to $1.5 million worth. And they have a landfill that was right next to them in Roxbury. And the Assembly and the Senate of New Jersey passed a bill in 6 days, and the governor of New Jersey signed that bill. 2 hours after he signed it, the state police went there and secured it. 2 days after that, the state of New Jersey paid for somebody to go there to spray this temporary containment over it. That was 9 days. We've been dealing with 49 years, and nobody's serious about coming here. The water that we're trying to protect, and they're trying to get the EPA to force Ford to remove all that stuff from those mine shafts, is to protect all the people that are this way, that drink that water. It's 2.5 million people every day. And if whatever measures that they put in place, that they think they're going to cap it instead of removing it, eventually it'll fail. We're human beings, right? Everything we put our, we're not perfect. There is nothing perfect. You know, so when those things fail, 2.5 million people, that reality of before, which was a hypothetical situation, could be a reality.
That was Vincent Mann of the Ramapo Lenape Nation. Learn more about the Two Row Wampum Renewal Campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.